welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by my colleague, Alexandra Mendonca, and Paul Osterman, who is a professor emeritus at MIT and has a new book coming out about disposable workers and changes in the way, particularly the American workforce, have changed the way people have jobs in the 21st century. Paul, congratulations on your new book. Thanks for coming on the show. Can you tell us what you found or how you decided to organize the types of workers that there are and the relationships that they have to their job? This seems to me to be the guts of your book.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to the conversation. The book begins with a line, which is that this is a book about divorce. It's a book about firms wanting to have bodies, people to do the work, but not wanting them to be employees. They're divorcing people from the family, as it were, from the family of employees at the firm. And what the book aims to do is to document why that's happening, how much of it is happening, what its consequences are, and what we might do about it. So what is happening? What's happening is that firms are using three different categories of workers to get the work done without making them employees. And I should add, by the way, that in the American context, being an employee does have a meaning. It means that you are entitled to a set of protections, legal protections regarding how you're treated by the firm. It means you're entitled to a set of benefits, healthcare, as well as health and safety controls and supports. And it means that you have an implicit contract with the firm. The contract is not that they'll never lay you off, but at least when they hire you, they intend to keep you and put you on some kind of career ladder. That's what being an employee means in the United States. It's not quite like having job tenure in some European countries that I'm familiar with. For example, in Spain, you have these funcionarios who have essentially lifetime job tenure. Being an employee in America is not that, but it is pretty substantial. So firms find that to be expensive. And I'll talk in a minute about why they want to stop doing that. But what they do is they use three strategies to avoid it. They use freelancing, which are people who are independent contractors who are working on their own. They use contractors. Contractors are employed actually by a staffing agency, but they're not employees of the organization where they do the work. And they use what is a new category to the book, marginal workers. These are folks who are technically employees in the organization, but they are never put on a career ladder. They're provided with very little training, and their jobs are designed so that they're high turnover jobs. And so no one stays around. Just as concrete examples, a freelancer might be a computer coder, programmer. That's very common. They might also be an Uber driver. Those are examples of freelancing. Contracting a whole range of activities from at the low end, security guards or landscapers, to at the high end, again, high-tech occupations or travel nurses, nurses who work for contracting companies and not for hospitals. And then marginal workers, many part-time people are marginal. Adjunct faculty, people in universities who have teaching assignments but no prospects of job tenure are other examples. So using an original survey, I find amazingly enough that 35%, more than a third of the American workforce, are in some sense disposable. They're either contractors, freelancers, or marginal workers. That's a lot of people. And that's been growing. And I show that it's been growing. So then the question becomes, why is that happening? And there are several reasons why it's happening. One is what you might call a benign reason. Companies need flexibility. Demand for their products go up and down. And they need to be able to adjust their workforce. But it's much more than that. Avoiding the cost of having employees is a dominant motive. So avoiding the cost of healthcare insurance, avoiding the cost of occupational health and safety insurance, workers' compensation insurance, unemployment insurance, those are all costs that they can avoid. And there's also another kind of cost, which doesn't have a dollar figure, but which is substantial, which is it's a hassle for management to deal with employees. It's a process cost. Economics literature wants to tell you that firms can pass costs on to employees in terms of lower wages, so why do we care? But that's not the case for all these process costs of you know, the difficulty of dealing with people who have actually rights inside the organization. And then a final motivation, which is insidious, is that firms don't respect their workforce. So McKinsey, the famous McKinsey consulting firm, issued a report that said that in their view, 95% of firms' value is produced by 5% of its workforce. That's being contemptuous of the other 95% of the workforce, right? Recently, a European bank chief said that he was laying off what he called low-value human capital. Again, so firms don't respect their frontline workforce, and that in turn also leads to a willingness to have these disposable workers. That's the kind of basic message and story of the book. There's a lot of data documenting all this, but that's the basic point.
Thanks so much for that. Chandra, we are in Europe and looking at a very different but also changing workforce where indeed jobs are no longer lifetime. People change more often. And there is sort of this tension about career track jobs versus temporary jobs, either on contract or with an expectation that people will move on. How do you see that looking right now?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Thank you, Paul, for joining us as well. I found your book quite fascinating because I think it was a bit of a refreshing approach to the current discussions on the labor market, because it's true that a lot of the ongoing debate has been focusing a bit on the AI component, right? How AI will replace workers, how ready we are for this AI wave. And I felt that you had the flip side of the story, which is, wait, we're still talking about people and they deserve to, you know, be treated considerably. I was very surprised by this 35% number, and it got me thinking a lot in terms of the European ideas. So as far as I'm aware, 31% roughly of young people in Europe are part-time workers or so along those lines. So, you know, it's a bit of a contrasting market. I was trying to think, where does this 35% number fit? Maybe self-employment could be figured like that. But then I went to see in the EU, the statistics point to 13%, the US 10.10% roughly, as far as I could tell. So there's no clear metric in Europe for this. The point that I take is that the US has clearly a more flexible labor market, even though some countries in Europe, we can think of the case of flexicurity in Denmark, where they combine flexible job-to-job transition with a very strong safety net that then could bounce people back into the job market. But there are contracts between the US and Europe. It's my understanding that whereas in the US, as you call it, firms wanting to have bodies but not necessarily employees, in Europe, it's my understanding that this is not what's been happening in the past decades, but the mood is changing a bit into that approach. For instance, the advocation of methodologies like flexicurity, which, I mean, I'm not advocating whether it works or not, but it's already a small step towards having more labor market flexicurity. So it really got me thinking how these two regions, I mean, the European Union as a region and the US as a country, are so different. And then a bigger scope on the role of technology. So I've been working a bit on AI adoption, but not just AI. There's a bigger discussion of technology, right? And there's especially over the 20th century, how different types of innovations disrupted labor markets. You make the case of journalism in your book. But this is something that's been ongoing for a while. What got me thinking is when we are looking at current AI statistics or the argument that AI will disproportionately harm young workers or people who are at the beginning of their careers, if we combine this already with this effect that it seems that when in an economy like the US, the number of disposable workers is very high and seems to be increasing, my take is that maybe in 10 years or so, conditioned on how fast the AI adoption is, then we may have workforce that basically nobody has full job security. You know, that seems to be one of the takeaways that I got from your book. And it really got me thinking because the statistics show that Europe is not there yet. There's more employment protection legislation in Europe than in the US. But I'm wondering if the narrative shifts in that dimension, then could we actually reach a situation where, you know, the bulk of the people don't really have any job security?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, what you just said. A couple of things. One is in terms of Europe, and I'm not an expert on European labor markets, though I'm interested. There are examples of what I'm talking about. So, for example, Spain, which is a country I know fairly well, there's what's called trabajo de basura, garbage jobs. Garbage jobs are jobs that look like the jobs I'm talking about in the book, and there's a lot of that. In Germany, they introduced a set of labor market reforms, the MERS reforms, that created the opportunity for more part-time jobs with less benefits, less securities. There is, as you say, a tendency towards the direction that I'm describing. Journalism, which you mentioned, is a really interesting case that I do talk about in the book because it shows both the upside and the downside. So technology obviously disrupted journalism. I mean, the fact that we're doing a podcast instead of an interview in a print journal, in a print venue, is obviously an example of this. But in many, many ways, technology disrupted journalism. So a lot of reporters had to go to becoming freelancers. Now, for some of these people, that's good. They have more work-family flexibility. They have an opportunity to work on the aspect of the subject that they like. One person I interviewed does book reviews as a freelancer before she had to do travel also. On the other hand, many people, as a result of this, are insecure, uncomfortable. They wish they were back in the newsroom. So it's complicated, right?
When it comes to journalism, there's an extra layer in that journalism is becoming more like novel writing in that you can't support yourself anymore writing book reviews and travel articles. Almost everyone who does that either has a partner who earns more and provides the health insurance for the American family, or they teach, or they have some other sort of day job. If you look at the freelance forums for journalism, you can see that publications are paying the same amount or less per word than they did 20 years ago. So journalism is a particularly interesting field in that the people who are participating in it as freelancers are different in some ways from the people who participated in it as employees. We also have podcasting. This is not a journalistic product, I want to be clear, as a former journalist, but it is fun and journalism adjacent, and it does give us the new media, you know, with sound, and some people are posting video on their websites. So the future of work is changing. And that's part of why I was excited to have you on the show, because in technology, to bring it back to what Alexandra was saying, we have all of these different industries that historically new technology has led to more jobs, but now there's a fear of what kind of jobs, are they garbage jobs? And I wanted to ask you about, to bring in yet another huge thing, immigration. You talk in your book about how H-1B visas and in the U.S., temporary skilled workers are being brought in to give the employer more control, maybe, and the worker less control, but still get the same amount of skilled labor done. How do you see that shaping up?
First, let me just give you my headline on AI, and we can go into more detail. My headline on AI is that we don't know what's going to happen with AI. But that's the point. Because we don't know what's going to happen with AI in terms of overall employment levels, firms who also don't know what's going to happen are facing uncertainty with respect to their staffing needs. And so they're going to make more use of these disposable workers than they have in the past. So whether AI kills more jobs or creates more jobs, whether the net outcome is plus or minus is one question. But the balance of work is going to even shift even more in the direction of disposability because of this uncertainty. And we can go into that if you'd like. Immigration is a really interesting point because the question is, what's the trend? What's the future trend for what the labor market's going to look like? Well, one trend is technology, AI, et cetera. The trend historically has also been, I would argue in the book, the trend towards disposability of the workforce, at least in the United States, and I think increasingly in Europe. But there's also another big trend, which is everyone my age, except for me, is going to die and retire and die or die and retire. That's going to create labor market shortages. Those have to be filled. And at least in the context of the United States, immigration, in my view, is a strong positive for our economic well-being in this country. And it's being restricted, unfortunately, in this country. That's another long-term trend, the shrinking labor force due to the aging workforce, followed by the difficulty of replacing those folks if the immigration policies continue as they are now, is another big, big process in the labor market. In some sense, yes, we want to pay attention to AI, but a focus on AI, we miss the other things that are going on.
Well, I was just going to say you wanted to come back to some of these aspects of technology, and I wanted to hear more about that, about the way that the firm uses its workers and sort of has to balance these different things.
Well, a historical perspective would lead you to ask, for example, about the internet. Now, the internet was as big a radical change as AI is, right? It completely changed our lives. It completely changed how we communicate. It completely changed communication channels within the firms. It created email, did a million different things. So what was the net effect on employment? Well, it was positive, right? Some people lost their jobs, but many people got new work because of the internet. Mainframe computers killed tons of jobs in filing. No, filing clerks don't exist anymore because everything is digitized, right? Computers digitized everything. Nonetheless, employment continued to grow. And in the United States, even with AI, employment is continuing to grow. Every month we get a jobs report and the number of new jobs is always positive. Sometimes it's a big number positive, sometimes it's a small number positive, but it's positive. So we just don't see the overall job killing thing so far. The question is how the content of jobs changes and how the distribution among different kinds of jobs change. So one thing we know is that jobs that are kind of people-facing, social services, healthcare jobs, those jobs are not going to be killed by AI. They may be improved by AI or they may be supplemented by AI, but they're not going to be killed by AI. Managers are still going to need to manage people. We may need fewer managers, but as the economy grows, that offsets that effect, and we're still going to need managers. Computer coders seem like they're going to be, those jobs are going away. Mid-level or low-level accountants, those jobs are going away. For other people, what's happening is that the balance of different tasks within their job is changing. So, for example, just take me as an example, which is so interesting to me. My work as an academic has changed. So when I write a paper now, I can use AI to do the computer programming for some statistical method. I can use AI to check for spelling errors. I can run the paper through AI to look for logical errors. So it's making me better. It's taking away some of my tasks, but it's not eliminating my job. So it's just a very complicated story. But, you know, the scary headlines, I think, don't make sense.
Allow me to pick up on that final point, which I think is very interesting. I don't perceive myself as an AI skeptic, so to speak, because I think this is quite a disruptive technology. But the fears or what we see now that a lot of large firms are displacing a significant number of workers and arguing that AI is one of the reasons, in my view, seems a bit premature, so to speak, because as you were saying, if we look at aggregate labor market statistics, even for the case of Europe, we do see that there is not yet that strong impact that people are expecting. Also, one thing that I think adds to the uncertainty that you were citing is that, for instance, if we look at a claim from the Anthropic CEO, Amodei, he argues that AI could eliminate half of all entry-level white-collar jobs by the end of the decade. But then we have a flip side of the discussion, which is the World Economic Forum that argues that AI will create twice as many jobs as it displaced by 2030. So we have a negative, so to speak, and a positive view on AI. But for me, the thing that also adds even further is that how does one measure how a job is affected by AI? You made your example of an academic. I also am an academic myself. It is true that some of the tasks that I do, I'm either outsourcing them directly to some sort of AI technology or improving on them, right? Some sort of AI augmented portion of my job. And therefore, one can argue that I'm becoming more productive at doing certain tasks. But what exactly does that mean? And how can I measure this, right? It's very complicated to understand the degree of exposure of a job to AI. There are some metrics in the literature. One that's quite cited is by Alon Du and co-authors. But even then, it's complicated to understand. If we perceive a job or an occupation as a continuum of tasks, right? Me as an academic, as you said, I write code, I get some aggregate statistics, I conceptualize an idea, I write the idea down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these tasks, they can be improved by AI. But at the end of the day, how can I argue what's the true impact of AI in my job? This is a very, in my view, a very blurred, or at the moment, it's still not clear how to measure these. And I think it adds more to this uncertainty that you were making. Because it's okay to scare the labor market, so to speak, that, oh, no, we're all going to lose our jobs. But it's true that there will be an impact. But will this impact be the one that we're framing nowadays? I think it's still very early to say. Early evidence, argues that we may start to see an impact on youth unemployment, right? That hiring rates for younger people have decreased, so to speak, or have slowed down compared to more senior levels. But even this is debatable depending on the region that we're looking at or even the type of data that we're using. And another point I'd like to hold on to is what you said about migration. Because I think that's very interesting, especially the point that you're making about people retiring. There's a fertility issue in most of the advanced economies, like the US and a lot of European economies. And then the point is that, okay, we can think that migration will help to fill those roles. But then when we look at actually statistics, and here I'm focusing on the U, this where I know best, we do see that there's a very high share of migrants, irrespective of whether they are from Europe, so European migrants living in another European country, or external European migrants living in a European country, that they are overqualified for the job that they're doing. There's also this mismatch problem that one has to tackle here.
Oh, absolutely, that's true. I mean, a concrete example is one of the things I do with my time is I teach English to immigrants, just because it's a way of helping people and makes me feel better about myself as well as helping people. Some of the people I'm teaching right now are immigrants who are doctors in their home country who are doing much lower level work in American hospitals because they can't work as doctors here. So that's true. But overall, the evidence I think is quite clear that second generation immigrants, they move up a ladder, they learn the skills, they enrich the country. So sure, there's problems with adaption and helping people assimilate, but it's positive for an economy. And it's very unfortunate. But, you know, you and I both use academics as examples, which is natural because that's our life. But, I mean, think about a salesperson. Think about how AI will help a salesperson. Well, it'll help them identify clients. It'll help them identify the most logical path that they should follow. I should approach this company first, that company second. It will help them identify the needs of their potential clients or people they're selling to. In many ways, it will help them. It's not going to eliminate their job, though. They still have to go and make a case to the client, the customer, about why they need that product. So there's lots of ways in which it's going to complement people. And there's a few jobs where it's just going to blow those jobs away. But historically, we've always had jobs that are blown away by technological change, but the economy continues to grow. That raises the public policy question, how you support the people who are damaged, because there will be damage. The United States has done a very, very poor job of supporting people who are negatively impacted by technological change. We've just not done a good job. There's two public policy issues. Again, this is in the American context. One is, what guardrails do you put around disposability? How do you kind of limit its scope or mitigate its impact on people? We haven't talked about the impact on people, but the book shows what that is, and it's not a pretty picture. And the other is, how do we support the people who are hurt, who are genuinely damaged? And those are questions which I think are both relevant to America and to Europe. Europe has done a much better job around guardrails than we have. And that's because you have a stronger union movement than we do in America, and it's because you have a longer tradition of kind of what you call tripartite bargaining between the business community, government, and employees. We don't have that tradition. Supports for people who are hurt, that's a challenge for everybody. And I have some views about that, but we've just done a bad job in this country.
If I may add, just to complement your point, because it's true that we were not talking on that side of the idea, but also in my mind gets a bit overlooked when discussing this, is that one cannot just think that by, you know, giving someone an AI tool that that person will be better at their job, right? This is also a technology one needs to learn how to use as a tool. And if we look at OECD statistics, we do see that, for instance, age differentials account for 53.6% of differences in AI use. So meaning that younger people use AI way more than older people. And the same also happens for education and income, where there's a 21% disparity. This is 2025 data. So the point is that there are socioeconomic aspects that also matter into this. So it's a bit the point that you were making before when we think about sales personnel, right? That they can use this technology to become better at the job. Yes, but they need to learn how to use this technology. So I think this is also a scope for policy intervention. Help people to use this tool to the best of their jobs and not allow for someone to be left behind because he or she is unable to just use or create an agentic AI.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So in another paper, not related to this book, but kind of adjacent to it, I have data on who engages in self-directed online training. That is to say, who gets on a website like Coursera or edX to pick up more skills, work-related skills? And then I have data on the characteristics of those people. And in this country, there's a strong bias towards people with a college education much more likely to engage in online training than people without a college education. So it goes again to this point about how you design a kind of a human capital system, a skill attainment system that leads to more equitable outcomes across the board, both to help people survive the kind of tumult of AI, but in general, to help them kind of improve their labor market circumstances. It's a challenge.
The European Union, they have this digital decade program that by 2030, they expect that some metrics in the European Union are met along these lines. And one of them is that they aim for 80% of adults in the EU to be able to use technology, and not necessarily AI, just technology, for everyday tasks. And today we are in, this is the state of 2026 or 2025 data, only 60% with a grain of salt, but 60% of adults can actually use tech for everyday tasks. So this is still a big gap. We're still far from that. So yeah, your point is spot on.
I have looked at OECD statistics on who uses self-directed online training, and they do show the same kind of disparities that we have in this country. Absolutely. And European training systems, in some respects, are much stronger than American systems in that you do a much better job in many European countries of embedding skill training in the high school, what I would call the high school curriculum. So young people coming out have higher skill levels than they do in this country. You tend to have a weaker system for retraining for adults than we do. We have institutions which are quite broad-based to retrain adults, community colleges being one, job training programs do another. And historically, Europe has lagged us in that respect, largely because the retraining of adults has occurred within firms, and that works fine as long as there's job security. But when the job security goes away, there's a problem.
Yes, there's not enough upskilling. Of course, some countries, we mentioned before, in Scandinavian countries, especially in Denmark, they do, as part of their flex security system, they have this upskilling or reskilling part embedded in their labor market. But it's true that that's not yet as common in Europe as one I would expect. But it's also related to the higher degree of employment protection, as you were saying, right? That's a very good point.
In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk more about policy options for dealing with these conditions and trying to create the best situation for society. Bruegel had a Future of Work project. Not too long ago, I wrote a paper for it about pension prospects for freelancers, because one gap that research identified was that freelancers don't even have the same opportunity to participate in a pension plan, even if they have the money or the desire to do so. In the U.S., we've also seen other moves to help people, for example, find health insurance with the Affordable Care Act. So I guess I would ask both of you, given what we see in the workforce, how can we change public policy to make things work better?
A good question. So my answer to this, in some sense, is going to be American specific, because now we're talking about what's the legislative environment. But I could state a few principles that apply to both America and to Europe. And then I'll talk a little bit about kind of a more American setting on this. So one principle is, how do you define who is an employee? Who's entitled to the full range of benefits of being an employee? That's the topic that has gotten the most attention in America because of the fear that all work is going to become Uberized. We're all going to be freelancers or Uber-like jobs. I argue in the book, and I show in the book, that that's just not right. Only about 1.5% of American workers work as rideshare drivers or food delivery drivers. Uber is a small phenomenon. And overall, among the category of disposable workers that I'm talking about, freelancers are the smallest group, 5 or 6% of the workforce. That said, in America, companies are increasingly pushing to kind of reclassify employees as independent contractors or freelancers. So Amazon wants its drivers to be freelancers now. Federal Express wants its drivers to be freelancers now. They're pushing on the margin. So you want to find some ways to control that. How you control that is very country specific. question, which we can talk about in America, but your listeners may be bored to death by American law, understandably. For contractors, which are a much larger fraction of the workforce and a big component of disposable work, the issue is if you work for a staffing company and you're assigned to work somewhere else, so you're a disposable worker for that somewhere else organization, and the staffing firm treats you as a commodity, how do you deal with that? And there, you really have to think about joint employment. That is to say, if you're assigned to work at a company, what responsibility does that company have for your well-being? Not just what responsibility does the staffing firm have? And there are real pushes in this country, in America, to make the company where you're assigned responsible for health and safety, responsible for protections with respect to discrimination and bad treatment of various kinds. It's a harder question about how you force that company to pay more money, provide a higher wage for you, because of course the company is using the staffing firm to drive down wages. So it's a question of how you put a floor on job quality across the board that would apply to these folks. And that's a similar question with respect to marginal workers. The people on short-term contracts, the people in high turnover jobs, the people who don't get any training from their company. You need to build employment standards for everybody across the board to raise the labor market floor. Europe has done a much better job than America on that. That's the kind of policy in America. In America, we also have, for drivers and for some contractors, non-union pressure groups. So rideshare drivers organize to form basically community organizations to push local governments, city councils or state governments, to enact employment standards. Not the federal government, not the national government. These pressure groups organized by rideshare drivers or by contractors are promising. The problem in this country is, first, they don't have a financial base. They're not unions. They can't require dues from their membership. So they're a little unstable. And secondly, in this country, they tend to be in the politically liberal states. And at least half the states in this country are not politically liberal and are not welcoming environment for those groups. So it's a complicated question. There are general principles that we could talk about, but enacting them is kind of a country by country, understand, get in the weeds and understand the nature of the legislation and the regulations.
Your points are spot on. I think from an European point of view, there's, I would argue, two main issues that one can think are more policy urgent, so to speak. On the one hand is the skill aspect. We do see that firms, for instance, the latest statistics show that in Europe, 57.5% of the firms have report difficulties in hiring information and communication technology specialists. There is a need for certain type of skills in certain countries. We do see that, for instance, in the case of the Netherlands, they have a very high job vacancy rate that comes together with a low unemployment rate. So it hints that there's not enough people to do certain types of jobs. And in Spain, we see the flip side of the coin, which is a very high unemployment rate with a low vacancy rate. So it seems that there's not enough jobs. So there is this labor mobility aspect of the EU that skills should be able to migrate to wherever they're needed, looking at the European Union as a single labor market with free labor mobility. So I think there's this aspect of developing the proper skills in Europe is key, and have an approach from a policy standpoint, which is not be reactive, but anticipate the future change and try to understand where the economy is going. And another issue, which I think is probably the main one in Europe, is retaining the talent. There's a very strong phenomena of brain exodus, right? Or extremely highly skilled people leaving their countries and moving elsewhere. And a lot of this migration happens internally in the EU, but it also happens to outside the EU, especially to the US. Making the point a bit of technology and AI, it's the case that retaining this type of talent in Europe is complicated. So this boils down to, making the jobs more attractive. I would think that Europe, by having a very strong employment protection legislation, goes to the points you were making about the US, that there's healthcare, the strong social policies, that there is public education in many of these countries, that will already be unattractive, but ultimately seems to boil down to wages as well. The wages in certain European countries are not competitive. To increase these wages, well, that's always the barrier. We see that if we make the contrast between the south and the north of Europe, that's already a very big gap, let alone when we think of the north of Europe versus the US. But it boils down to developing policies that value people for their skills. And I think that's the key issue here, because the European labor model has been hankered a lot on promoting education. Some of the countries had very significant gaps when it comes to university education. There's been a lot of investment towards making sure that people get more educated, that they are able to have more opportunities in their life. But then it goes on to developing the jobs that match that. And I think that's where the policy intervention should happen.
Yeah. So in the American context, firms, particularly manufacturing firms, have complained for decades about labor market shortages. We can't get anybody to work at our factory. When you interview these firms, you ask them, well, what do you pay? And it turns out they pay poorly. Over the years, I've become cynical about complaints about we can't find anybody to do our work because, you know, the first answer is improve the quality of your job and you'll find people. That's not to deny. There's spot shortages here and there. You know, I'm cynical or skeptical, I should say, about some of these complaints. Just like I'm skeptical, again, in the American context, where CEOs will say, our people, our human capital is our most important asset, and then they have a third of their workforce disposable. So I think you need to be careful, but I'm not denying it here and there, there's a problem. In Europe, based on my stupid American ignorance, my joke about Europe is the real problem with labor market mobility is that everybody wants to live close to their mother. And so they don't want to travel. In Spain, I keep coming back to Spain. In Spain, the country I know quite well, in fact, that is the case. Everyone wants to live close to their mother. Saying that in a kind of a more serious vein, family structure and family supports and culture play a role in labor market mobility, not just labor market issues. Public policy may not be the appropriate way to think about that, and it may not even actually be a problem. It's nice people want to live next to their mother. But yes, I think the European phenomenon about mobility is a different phenomenon than the American one. In America, there's quite a bit of mobility. The question is improving job quality.
I understand the point you're making. I think there's a cultural aspect that's very strong in certain countries, but I would still argue that there's been an increasing phenomenon of younger people. Of course, I'm talking about a niche of the population, but that there's already certain groups of people who go to university that end up migrating within Europe. So more and more we see this phenomenon, the brain drain phenomenon, right, that I mentioned before. It's very strong in the south of Europe. But I also think that there's another issue in Europe, which actually goes to the point you made, which is some of these countries also that even if one were to be willing to live further away from the family or any other relative or friends, then there's a whole mobility aspect when it comes to infrastructure and how easy it is to navigate within the countries. But that's a separate discussion than the one we're having. But it's all this idea that, of course, we can create a firm in a small town somewhere in the south of Spain. But if there's no way to get there, I mean, why would people move there just to be isolated to work? I get your point, but it comes also with developing infrastructure to make sure that people don't necessarily have to be close to their family. But should they need to go, they can easily go. But it's true that the job culture between Europe and the US is a bit different. But I think ultimately boils down to the same point you made, which is having a quality job, right? A decent job. The Commission is trying to push some policy towards what they're calling the Quality of Jobs Act. They've been working on that. But ultimately it boils down to people being allowed to, you know, have a life, buying a house, having children, having a car or something along those lines. And even though in Europe we have stronger, I keep going down to this, but stronger social insurance mechanisms, so to speak, than in the US, perhaps in some countries, it boils down ultimately to a wage issue, right? That people are just not paid well enough, even the costs. But I feel we're detracting a bit.
I think it's all part of the conversation. And Alejandro, I also want to ask you, how is the European Convention of Social Partners, how is that adjusting to the new workplace dynamic?
So you're talking about unions, employers together?
So yeah, this was new for me when I moved to Europe 15 years ago, the idea that employers, employees, and civil society would function as sort of a collective known as social partners and work within the policy process to try and improve society. It's a different way of organizing than we think about things in the US. And it also seems to me to be shifting because jobs are shifting and you no longer necessarily have union jobs for life in the same place that made that structure work as well as it may have.
Yes, I mean, it's true. Of course, we're talking about 27 labor markets, so I don't want to say one size fits all. There are specific cases where certain mechanisms work stronger than others. But I think one trend that seems to be common is that the power of the unions seems to be decreasing more and more. We see that on certain countries where parties who are traditionally more associated with union rights, labor movements are losing power. We also notice that phenomena such as public protests are not as strong as they used to be. Of course, as I said, there's not one size fits all. There are countries and countries that have different attitudes towards that. But I think it's a common trend. And I think the main takeaway that I get is that unions in general are losing power. We can think of a case like Sweden. We know that unions, they have a strong power, but it's still the case that it's very hard to fire someone, but firms can still find mechanisms to go around it, either by arguing through the restructuring. So these are new trends, right? They come more and more that, you know, the cost-saving part of a firm is still quite strong, and it comes at the cost usually of the worker. So I would argue that within this mechanism that you were discussing, this European social mechanism, unions seem to be the one that are losing more power, perhaps also because workers maybe are disconnected from unions. Because it's true that a lot of these rights that exist in Europe have been acquired during the past century, especially. And now we are adjusting to a new reality that's completely different than the one that we had 100 years ago. So perhaps it's time to rethink the role of unions, not in a negative way, but if anything, maybe perhaps to give them power. Don't get me wrong, I'm advocating in favor of unions, but also rethink how can they have power adjusted to the current labor market.
In the book, I use an analogy with sharks, you know, that swim in the ocean. We need sharks. Sharks are good for the ecosystem, but what we do is we create barriers around our beaches so that they don't chew on us, right? Well, firms are like sharks. At the end of the day, they have only one objective, which is to maximize profits. Anything else that they say about what they're trying to do is rhetoric. And you can see that in America, where 2 years ago, firms were all about equal employment opportunity, and so on. And they were all about the environment. And today they don't even talk about any of that. That rhetoric goes away. And at the end of the day, what they're about is making money. Now, that's a good thing. Firms invent new products. Firms create jobs. We want firms and we want them out there trying to make money, but we want to put some barriers around it, right? Just like we want to do with sharks. And so the question is how you prevent firms from trying to make all work disposable, to use the language in the book, what guardrails you put on it, what floors you put on job quality. That's the phenomenon that we want to talk about, recognizing that it's also true firms do need flexibility, that the world is much more competitive. Product markets are much more competitive than they used to be. Firms are competing internationally and they're facing real challenges. So they do need some flexibility, but we also need barriers, guardrails, and floors. And that's what's so complex about how to think about that. But at the end of the day, I think we also want to, you won't be surprised to hear me say this, think you want to take the fundamental message of the book, which is that right now a third of the American workforce is disposable, and that's problematic. We haven't talked about the consequences yet, but the consequences are lower wages, less job satisfaction, more insecurity. And so we need to deal with it. It's a multi-level problem.
I agree with you. We haven't really discussed the consequences of having people working under those conditions, and it's worrisome, especially if, according to your book, this number is set to increase. But then I was wondering once again, is how does one revert this trend? I think that's the question that I have in my mind. Now I'm playing the role of Rebecca, but I was thinking, how does one revert this trend? I think that's the question exactly that we haven't addressed.
So again, trying to avoid being too American-centric here. One is to clearly define what it means to be an employee so that firms don't have the temptation to reclassify employees as freelancers. You want to limit that. Secondly, you need to reduce the incentives that firms have to create disposable workers. So some of those incentives are the cost of healthcare in America, the cost of healthcare, the cost of a range of benefits. So it would not be unreasonable to shift, of course, you want to provide health care, you want to provide those benefits. It would not be unreasonable to try and shift those costs to the public rather than to individual firms. Now, getting universal health care in America has proved to be extremely challenging, but something along those lines would reduce the incentives that firms have to create disposable workers. And the third, broadly speaking, strategies to put a floor on job qualities. Jobs must pay at least X. People must receive some level of training. People must receive workers' compensation for workplace injuries. In other words, you know, improve the floor. Broadly speaking, I think those are the three strategies that would make sense. The consequences, as I said, which the book does document, of disposability are lower wages, worse job satisfaction, and very unequally distributed. And so it's a problem.
The point is basically that the consequences, such as an increase in the share of jobs that are with precarious conditions, and in the end, it's not dignified work. That's the main takeaway for me.
It's worth turning this around in our heads, I think. And as we move toward the end, I wanted to come back to a table in Paul's book that really stayed with me. It had four categories of workers who were part-timers, either by choice or not by choice, and showing who was satisfied and who was dissatisfied with that arrangement. And it really pointed to those with higher skills are willing to trade money for autonomy. And those with lower skills are willing to accept it if it's the only job they can get, but would really prefer to have a little less autonomy and a little more money. Paul, is that a fair restatement of some of the ideas you were trying to get across?
Yeah, so the book shows, I think, that many freelancers choose that status because they want the flexibility. In fact, they, you know, in my both interviews and surveys, that's true. Contractors who are worse paid, at least on an hourly basis, are dissatisfied and would rather have, you know, more money. And that's also true for marginal workers. So there's heterogeneity in the disposability, which again shows that the object of the game here is not to eliminate all these disposable jobs, it's to make them into better jobs and to put guardrails around them. But we do need to recognize that firms need some degree of flexibility, and some people want that flexibility. The subtle problem is how you kind of accept those facts, but also create better work. But yes, so your summary is correct.
Ashandra, any last thoughts?
I was thinking, I mean, it was a pleasure to read your book and understand a bit more about how the U.S. labor markets work. And yeah, it will inspire for sure future research that I've been thinking about. Where does Europe want to go moving forward? So thank you very much. This has been really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, both of you. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. This podcast and all of our related research will be available for free on our website. And the podcast is also, along with its brethren, on all of your favorite podcast channels. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. We've been joined today by MIT professor Paul Osterman and Bruegel's Alexandra Mendonca. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.